Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 15th. Do we have any authors here? All right, we're going to start with my bill then. So, members, the first bill we're going to start with, we don't have any other authors. We're going to start with House File 1162. That's the chair's bill. So the chair will move House File 1162 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And there is an author's amendment. At this time, I will move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form that I would like. Is there any corrections, changes, or additions to that? No, never mind. That's my amendment. Forget it. Do we have the A2 amendment? Oh, we pulled it. Never mind. There is no amendment. So I do have an invited testifier, Mr. Dorman. And then after that, we have three additional testifiers who've signed up. And members, what this does, this addresses the issue of we currently have a pot of money for the Challenge Grant Program. In addition, we have an issue with workforce housing, so it takes part of the Challenge Grant Program and puts it into workforce housing. So, that's what that bill does. I'm sure we'll have quite a bit of testimony on it. Mr. Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the House file you have in front of you today attempts to, for the last couple of years, our organization has been advocating for a workforce housing tax credit program. And through this process, you know, it goes through the committee hearings and other things. As you meet with the agencies, you meet with the governor's office. Both the governor's office and Commissioner Deed suggested, rather than using Deed as we had suggested and actually prefer, that their preference was that it ran through MFHA. So the bill was designed to create a grant program under MHFA that would operate a lot like that tax credit program, Mr. Chair. One feature about using MHFA, even though I'm not sure I read the statute the same way MFHA does, is that they're now saying that their programs avoid prevailing wage, and so that would be a benefit of doing the grant program under MHFA versus Deed, even though I'm not sure why, you know, same money, same legislature, why it wouldn't apply to both. But here nor there, Mr. Chair, that is another feature. I do want to make one thing very clear, because I've read a couple of letters. We had a hearing on this in the Senate, and I was surprised to learn. I thought I should be renaming myself the Sheriff of Nottingham, because I was accused of robbing from the poor. To be very clear, there's a challenge grant funding under an existing statute, and then we crafted this to go underneath there somewhere. We could have crafted it differently. We asked MHFA for a copy of a legal opinion they say they have that relates to prevailing wages. They wouldn't share that with us, and without that, we weren't sure how better to craft the amendment. But to be very clear, whatever amount that this committee and you, Mr. Chair, decides to put in a regular challenge grant program is fine by us. We don't have a position for or against it. What we're asking for is $6.6 million on top of it. So we're not trying to steal anybody's money, take anybody's money. We're trying to say this is a need that isn't being met by the existing program. One of the other things that we've heard in some of the other committees is, gee, why don't you open this up and allow blended projects, meaning market rate and income control. A couple things I would say to that. I mean, it sounds good, but in the projects that I've examined that are blended in nature, it really drives up the soft costs of those projects quite a bit. I'd rather see more projects get done. And I took a look at the history in the last several years of blended projects, and I think since 2011, only about 68 workforce housing units have been built that way. So we're afraid it wouldn't result in the number of units that we'd like. But, Mr. Chair, it's a modest request, $6 million versus the I don't know, hundreds of millions that run through MHFA and state and federal money every year. So we're not trying to be everything to everybody, but we do think this is an important need. Whether it be in Elberly and Austin, my neck of the woods, up in the Thief River Falls in Roseville, Jackson, you can hardly go anywhere in greater Minnesota, and you'll hear about that. Mr. Chair, maybe to give you some more detail, to my left is Elberly City Manager Chad Adams, and he was kind enough to drive up today to visit with the committee and let you know about why this is important to communities like Albert Lea.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Adams. Please introduce yourself and proceed with the testimony. And are you, in fact, the sheriff of Nottingham?
I am not.
Okay. All right. Just to be clear. For the record, no, the testifier is not the sheriff of Nottingham. Please proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am Chad Adams, the city manager of Albert Lea, and want to note that workforce housing and programs like this have been our top priority for the last couple of years and is for 2017 moving forward, as designated by not only city staff but also our city council through goal-setting sessions. We simply have a lot of open jobs in the community that cannot be filled due to a lack of workforce, market rate, rental housing. This can be attested by a number of our largest employers, our school district, Mayo Clinic, a lot of our industries in the manufacturing business. We're trying to grow, and this issue continues to come forward and has been noted as one of our chamber's top priorities as well for the last couple of years, as well as in 2017. And outwardly, up until last year, we didn't have any new workforce housing units, rental units, created for 30 years. Tax abatement from the city, county, and school are being used to try to fill some of the gaps that we're seeing from developers, but we need more help than just those tools because that's turning out to be insufficient amount of dollars to fill those gaps. We recognize as a city that we have to continue to have skin in the game and be a partner financially along with this program regarding market rate and workforce housing. To be a little bit more specific about the challenges that we actually see from developers, we require pro forma analysis from developers to illustrate the true gap that they need to create workforce housing in greater Minnesota and in Albert Lea specifically. City staff and other financial consultants that we utilize as another set of eyes help verify these gaps. On an average 18-unit development, the gap often ranges from $400,000 $800,000 total for that type of a development. I should also note that this has become a large priority in Southeast Minnesota, where I've been a part of Southeast Minnesota Together, and I'm steering a committee on workforce housing, and we'll be having a workforce housing summit in May in Rochester to try to address from a developer standpoint and from a community standpoint how we can continue to resolve this issue, and certainly I'm looking for support from this committee on this legislation. Simply put, we need more tools to create workforce housing in greater Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. The next on the testifier list is Aaron Dady. And then on deck is Todd, is it Pathke? I think you both come down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Aaron Dady. I'm a volunteer board member with Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, serving the 7th County metro area. Our mission is to eliminate poverty housing and to make decent, affordable shelter for all people a matter of conscience. We're extremely grateful for the thousands of community volunteers and generous donors who have partnered with us since 1985, making the dream of home ownership possible for over 1,100 families. Habitat home buyers are prepared for home ownership through a combination of sweat equity, one-on-one financial coaching, home ownership training, and ongoing support, resulting in increased stability and decreased use of public resources. Affordable housing, as you know, is a multi-generational game changer for families and communities. A recent Wilder research report found habitat home ownership leads to greater school success, healthier kids, stabilized families, and stronger neighborhoods. As a Homes for All Coalition member, comprised of over 150 nonprofits, faith communities, housing developers, school districts, health providers, and local units of government, we collaborate to secure investments in a continuum of services from homelessness prevention to homeownership. We are pleased that House File 1162 spotlights the critical need to develop more affordable workforce housing, as our own waiting list for Habitat Homes far exceeds current resources for these working families. We are concerned, though, that this bill does not bring any new funding to meet this need, but instead diverts funding from the Challenge Fund to meet a subset of the statewide workforce housing need. The Challenge Fund is a flexible program that supports both rental and home ownership development in metro, suburban, and rural communities. Twin Cities Habitat, 29 other statewide Habitat affiliates, and many other affordable housing developers across the state currently use this important tool to make homes affordable for working families. This bill would effectively reduce resources and increase competition among developers that piece together the needed funding to create affordable rental and home ownership opportunities statewide. So rather than divert funds from the current Challenge Fund, we think that Minnesota families would be better served by an increase to the Challenge Fund, such as the Homes for All request for a $4 million increase. Thank you so much for your time and for your commitment to addressing the need for safe and affordable housing for Minnesotans statewide. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Pafke? And this is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Commissioner, you'll be next.
Mr. Chair, if I may just leave the podium for a moment and allow Councilmember Jeff Brand from St. Peter to talk a little bit, and then if I could have a few minutes, that would be great.
Okay, well, you're kind of cutting to the front of the line, but that's okay. I guess, well, Commissioner said
it'll
okay?
be very quick.
The Commissioner said it was okay. That's all right.
It'll be very quick.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Yes, my name is Jeff Brand, City Council Member in St. Peter. Thanks for having me today to talk about what works in St. Peter. I'm a five-year City Council Member. We've been working quite extensively on the housing section of what works in St. Peter for quite a long time. We've had three iterations of development, whether it be the Nicollet Meadows, Washington Terrace, and now with Traverse Green in St. Peter, where we're actually forging ahead and creating opportunities for homes in St. Peter where otherwise the market isn't showing up to develop that land. We actually just put forth a request for bid proposals for 15 acres, and nobody showed up to the table with a proposal at all. But by that same token, we've got folks in the community who are actually actively looking for a developer because they want to live out there. They actually do want to develop homes in that area. So from our standpoint, St. Peter's a little bit interesting as far as the numbers go. Our vacancy rate for rental is less than 1%. We've got 30 homes or less for sale in St. Peter right now, when we should have a healthy number of at least 90 or more. Home sales continue to go. It's a seller's market right now, which is a good thing for St. Peter. This makes the case for why housing in our community is good for economic development. As far as making it go, we spent a lot of time talking about Traverse Green, our recent project here in St. Peter. We all had a lot of heartburn about whether or not the numbers are going to work itself out. We used a lot of things, a lot of entities. We talked with Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership. They worked together with the City of St. Peter and the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to create the package that we have now. We're offering these parcels for sale in St. Peter. The process was quite an extensive process. It wasn't something we just quickly completed. It took a lot of time, a lot of insight. We had to make sure that the numbers worked for us in St. Peter. Luckily, we were able to make it go, and people are now purchasing in St. Peter. Also want to talk about the future for St. Peter. We're talking about sustainable growth opportunities for St. Peter. By having more homes on the market, what we're able to do is provide opportunities for new businesses to come to town, new services to be provided to existing customers, and citizens rather, and also new customers for those businesses. And that's important for places that sell cars, that sell insurance, that sell groceries all across the board. They hire people in our community. Those are good-paying jobs, and we want to continue to make sure that we have those good-paying jobs in St. Peter, so that helps. We've also had a lot of great partners that we've worked with over the years, including Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Department of Economic Development, and also the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. If you do decide to do anything, please direct your attention to House File 1020, which will allow for these grants to remain, these challenge grants to remain, but will provide an additional $6.5 million in workforce housing credits to continue to do what's good for Greater Minnesota and provide some additional opportunities for us to continue working on workforce housing. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Todd Krafke, I'm the City Administrator in St. Peter, and thank you for the few moments. The Challenges Program has been very effective in St. Peter. It's provided enough flexibility for us to not only build multifamily units, but also single-family units, which, as Councilmember Brand has mentioned, has been very significant. You know, our hope continues to be that, frankly, more dollars go into housing overall, However you choose to do that, more dollars are needed to meet the needs that are certainly available or are going to be available within St. Peter and the rest of greater Minnesota. We're happy to answer questions about specifics related to St. Peter, but again, more resources are really necessary, and we'll continue to work with programs that have worked very well for us, and this is one of those programs.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your testimony. Commissioner?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Tungerthal. I'm commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And I think if there's one thing that this committee has heard over the last several days is the dramatic need for affordable housing, both ownership housing and rental housing within the state. And one of those subsets is definitely a continuing need for workforce housing, actually not only in greater Minnesota but in the metro area as well. And I'm really pleased to say that since this body decided 2 years ago to establish a program at DEED for workforce housing, that together we and DEED over the last 4 years have financed more than 1,200 units of both rental and homeownership workforce housing located throughout the state. And it is in literally every region of the state: Thief River Falls, Roseau, Worthington, Jackson, St. Michael, Cambridge, Glenwood, Perham, Austin, Rochester, Owatonna, Mankato, Duluth, Hinckley, Grand Marais, and Lutzen. And we really, by our actions, have no quarrel with the need for workforce housing. What we do have a quarrel with is that typically when we are doing our consolidated request for proposals, we receive 3 to 4 times as many applications for housing that does happen to have income limits than we are able to grant. The Challenge Program, since 1999, when it was created by this committee, has been the essential ingredient for helping communities around the state, like St. Peter, like the Habitat for Humanity chapters around the state, to provide that gap financing that they need to make either homeownership, new construction housing work, or rental housing that does happen to have income limits. So our concern is one that cutting the program in half for the Challenge Program would mean that we would probably have 6 to 7 times as many applicants as we are able to fund. So there's not a question about need for housing. There's a question about where those dollars are located. I would note that within the base budget for DEED, that there already exists proposed funding of $2 million for the existing DEED workforce housing, which, as I said, has in many communities operated side by side with the Challenge Program, I think, to the pleasure of those communities. In fact, last summer I was up in Perham at a groundbreaking for a project that was funded through the Challenge Fund, and a project funded through the DEED program was scheduled to have a groundbreaking a couple months later just down the block. I'd like to address the comment that Mr. Dorman made about the idea of allowing for projects to have blended financing. This is something that I've talked with a number of you about. And to be clear, if this committee was to consider something like that, we would not in any way suggest that it be a requirement of any workforce housing that you might fund at DEED, but rather just an allowable activity. So for those communities that maybe saw the opportunity to build one 80-unit building instead of two 40-unit buildings, that would be possible within the financing structure. The tools that we use, the Federal Low Income Housing Tax Credit, the Challenge Fund, do allow for combining resources within a building. But it is the proposal that would create this workforce housing program, as well as the tax credit, as well as the deed program that prohibits the combining of those funds. So I just want to be clear, we're not suggesting that it must be combined, simply that we think it makes sense for communities to decide as they work with developers whether they want to encourage that the funds be combined so that there can be some economies of time and scale. Finally, we are very concerned with the language in the bill that is quite specific about how the program must be administered, including the requirement for a 15-day turnaround time and a non-competitive allocation process. So it literally would be first come, first serve, very little time to look at applications according to the mandates of this legislation. So with that, I will also comment that this program requires that the money be put into projects in the form of grants. It has been the practice and continues to be the practice of Minnesota Housing that money goes into rental projects in the form of deferred loans. So that way, if a developer chooses to sell the property as a market rate property that has relatively high incomes, that certainly could happen in certain areas where property values are appreciating, we would have the option of requiring that money to be repaid and recycled back into programs in other communities in the state. So not only are we concerned about the dollar amount, but we are concerned with some of the specific provisions of the workforce housing fund that is established by this legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there any other members of the public which testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion. We'll do member questions or comments. Questions or members of the committee? Representative Mahoney?
So this is a question for you, Mr. Chair. What's in the fiscal staff, what's in the base for the challenge grant this year?
Mr. Zempel, I believe the challenge grant program is funded at about 13.4 a year, or is it 12.4? But I'll defer to House staff on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the base funding for fiscal 18 and onward is $12.925 million per year.
Representative Mahoney.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, your bill, you want to take half of the money from the challenge grants? Is that correct? Is that how I'm reading this?
That is correct. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, maybe it's not Mr. Dorman who is the sheriff of Nottingham, but someone else in this room. I just find it. We go through this every year, and all the other programs that have been put together for workforce for market rate housing have not actually worked the way they were supposed to work. So you keep coming back trying some different particular avenue. This bill is not going to actually work the way it's envisioned. Obviously, for the reasons that the commissioner just said. And I'm still tired from last night. I'd go more, but Mr. Chair, I don't think your bill works. There are other ways that you might want to think about how to do it, but this one isn't going to work.
Well, Representative Mahoney, when you're more awake, I look forward to your input on how we can improve upon the bill. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I just wondered if you could elaborate a little bit more, and then maybe the author of the bill could tell me his thinking, too. But the couple of the points you made had to do with concern about the turnaround time for approving or rejecting a grant application being 15 days. You indicated that could be a problem. Could you just describe a little bit more about that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, we have found that when we have dollars available for affordable workforce housing, that there is more demand than there is available dollars. And so we feel it's a pretty important component to provide funds on a competitive basis. This basically requires us to accept and decide whether applications are eligible and then fund them on a first-come, first-served basis. The 15 days, we think that that is probably not sufficient to analyze the pro formas, as you heard the mayor talk about, in order to determine whether these look to be projects that will work in the long run and be sustainable housing.
So given this proposal, who would be the winners and losers? Are we, you know, are we talking about, you know, pretty well-funded developers versus smaller town and smaller group proponents? I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, if there is this huge demand versus the opportunity versus what we have available for resources, and if it's this quick turnaround time, I'm guessing the folks who are here probably testifying in support of this already have it, probably have some projects ready to go, whereas there might be others who are, you know, become aware of this opportunity and are going to be disadvantaged. Is that some of what you're thinking about, or could you just say a little bit more?
I'm sorry, what was the question for the commissioner?
The pros and cons of why we would have and who the winners and losers are if we have such a short turnaround time. And this is based on my question is based on the fact that there's this huge demand and you know, the ability to get a project put together, and then the commissioner turning it around, having to come first serve. I'm guessing some people benefit more than others from that, and I'm wondering if you could just describe who that is.
First and part of the question is who the winners and losers would be, and what was the second part of it?
Well, that's basically it. How that works practically.
From your perspective, who would you view as the winners and losers under this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the Housing Finance Agency has not worked with the developers that are envisioned, I think, for this program, but certainly on the affordable housing development side, if it were a first-come, first-served program, it would be the more established, more well-capitalized developers, I would think, that would be in a position to be in a first-come, first-served basis kind of situation. I was frankly baffled by this part of it because even the program that's currently funded at DEED is done on a competitive basis. So I honestly didn't understand why these scarce program dollars were being made available on a first-come, first-served basis with no ability to judge the projects on their level of need or merit or the needs of the community where they're located.
Representative Maquette?
Mr. Chairman, just ask you a question.
Oh, excuse me. Representative Clark, another question. Go ahead.
Well, as the author of the bill, I'm just wondering, what do you see as the advantages of having this very short turnaround time?
As the commissioner has testified to, and as Mr. Dorman testified to, and as you're aware of, we have had a perpetual problem with workforce housing that has stretched over multiple bienniums. And what I'm trying is a new approach to, number one, make those resources available, number two, to remove some of the regulatory framework that exists in DEED that may be more streamlined under MHFA, and third and finally, I don't know what the target for this committee is going to be, Representative Clark. So I wanted to put forward a bill that I know would address the issues regardless of whether the size or lack thereof the target of this committee is going to have. So that was the intent of my bill. Certainly I'm willing to work with you because we are not voting on this bill today. We're laying it over. And certainly I'm willing to take advice and suggested Robert Marks and that. But Representative Clark, did you have another comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would just ask you to consider this issue of having enough time. You know, at the agency, that was the first question I was asking, is this quick turnaround time, who does it benefit and who doesn't it benefit? And I think what I understood is, you know, some of the smaller developers or communities with particular need might be disadvantaged is kind of what I'm worried about, and that's what I thought I heard. But I did have a second question because there were two.
A fifth question, Representative Clark, not a second one. This is a fifth one.
Okay. the issue of grants versus deferred loans. That was one of the other points that the commissioner raised, and I'm wondering why you prefer grants versus deferred loans, Mr. Chairman. I understand you have good intention. I'm not questioning that, but in this case, it does have repercussions, and what would be your reason for that?
Representative Clark, as you know, whenever there's an RFP process that tends to lengthen out the project timelines, I know that there are projects in queue in many markets right now that are ready to go that we've been trying to jumpstart, not for months but for years. And so that was my intent of having this language in there. Again, Representative Clark, and to anyone watching, if people have a better way to address those issues to streamline or accelerate those projects, what I don't want to do is lose another year of the construction season and come back next year and have the same problems. So, Representative Clark?
So, Mr. Chairman, I've moved on from the question about timing to the question of grants versus deferred loans. That isn't a timing question. That's a resource question. And I'm just wondering, because when they're deferred loans, we have a revolving fund and we have a commitment to the community that those projects are actually kept there and so on. So what is your reason for wanting to have grants rather than deferred loans?
Representative Clark, the reason why is that the program I'm seeking to improve upon is a grant program in the Department of Employment and Economic Development. That's a grant program. It's not a revolving loan. Representative Clark?
Okay. And so, Mr. Chairman, so you're not discussing the impact on the Challenge Fund and the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, then you're focusing on DEED. Is that correct?
No, you had asked me why I was making it a grant versus a revolving loan, and because what I'm envisioning is that if we're going to take care of workforce housing in MHFA versus DEED, then I would want to mimic the DEED program as much as we could. The DEED program is a grant program. It's not a revolving loan. Representative Clark.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's a matter, you think it's more efficient. Is that the main, my understanding, that your main reason?
Representative Clark, as I stated, my intent is I want to replicate the parts of that program that are working without replicating the parts that are not working. And right now it is a grant program. Representative Clark.
Okay, well then I'll just ask you, let's keep working on this because I do think it does have some repercussions in terms of who's going to benefit, who's going to have the opportunities.
Representative McQuaid.
And Mr. Chair, this question would be for you or Commissioner Tinkerbell. I just want some numbers. Last year, I just want to know the percent of applicants in Greater Minnesota and then the percent that were granted, and then the same for the Metro for these challenge grants.
Does the Commissioner or nonpartisan staff have that information? No. Commissioner, do you know that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's not a number I have off the top of my head.
What?
We have dozens of applications, so we'd be happy to get back to you with
that. If you could please forward it to the committee administrator or committee legislative assistant, we'll forward the answer to that question to every member of the committee. Representative McQuaid. Thank you. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, Commissioner, I look forward to working with you, not only as we draft the omnibus bill, but also going forward. This is the first step in a long process, and of course, the first process will be taking place sometime here this month where we get the target for this committee. But I know that you're committed to helping out those who need affordable housing as well as workforce housing, and I look forward to working with you as do the members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So with that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 1162 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Fenton. Representative Neuberger moves that House File 1394 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Fenton, do you have any amendments to your bill?
No, Mr. Chair, I do not.
Representative Fenton, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1394 is related to the dislocated worker program, and in this House File 1394, what I do is I clarify that campaign staffers would not qualify for the benefits of this program. The dislocated worker program was designed for mass layoffs of 50 workers or more at places like iron mines, manufacturing plants, perhaps stores, stores coming up that are closing where workers would be able to qualify for the benefits such as Macy's downtown. Other companies in 2015 that had layoffs where their employees benefited, Target, Heatec, Mintec, Dakota Premium plant closing, Aero Electric, and so on. The reason this bill came about is because Pat Kessler in mid-December did a story on 50 to 60 DFL campaign staffers unfortunately lost their job with the election. And so what they did for the first time ever, they banded together to organize a group to earn special status as victims of a mass layoff. And I used to work at the party. And when we hired, whether it be trackers or staffers for
campaign, when you say you worked for the DFL party?
I worked for the Republican Party, I'm sorry. And I will say that if this were my own party doing this, I would be up here before you today as well. It doesn't matter whether Democrat, Republican, Independent. I worked at the party where we hired trackers or campaign staff, and we always had a statement in our contracts that said that I understand that this is a temporary employment. And so Pat Kessler asked for my advice, and I do think that it should have been clarified whether or not campaign staffers would qualify, and I think that the law actually suggests that they would not. But I made a I made a promise that I would make sure to clarify it if it wasn't. And I brought this bill about because I came across Deed's 2015 fiscal year report. And on the second page of that, under customers, they state, to be eligible for the DW program, an individual typically must qualify for UI, unemployment insurance. The DW program excludes temporary or seasonal workers, however. And so I'm clarifying this within that language that that staffers would not qualify for those benefits. And it's benefits such as rent and mortgage, utility bills, car payment, and job training. And with that,
Representative Fenton, do you have any invited testifiers?
I do not.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Yes, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annie Welch. I am the director of the Dislocated Worker Program with the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm here to provide impartial data to you all as an executive staff person. Basically, I just wanted to go through some of the overview of the Dislocated Worker Program that in Minnesota we've operated a federally funded program since 1983. We've also operated a state-funded Dislocated Worker Program since 1990. That is funded out of what was originally called the Dislocated Worker Fund, now called the Workforce Development Fund. And, of course, Representative Fenton lays things out very clearly that typically, to be eligible for the Dislocated Worker Program, individuals would need to be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits. They must have lost their jobs through no fault of their own. We also have a few specific pieces with the state-funded program that individuals who are self-employed, this also counts for the federal program, but who lose their jobs due to economic conditions would be eligible for the program. Veterans leaving active duty, individuals of the National Guard leaving that duty, displaced homemakers, individuals who are long-term unemployed, which we define as 15 or more weeks, not necessarily consecutive. Those individuals would all be eligible for the Dislocated Worker Program. A large portion of the program does serve individuals impacted by mass layoffs, which we follow federal law of qualifying that as 50 or more individuals in a 30-day window. However, a large portion of our program also does serve workers who are impacted by smaller layoffs. I'd be happy to field any questions should any of you have any of them.
Is there any other members of the public who should testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion, move to member questions. Representative Fenton, quick question for you. Number one, would this apply to like members of the staff, members from the legislature who are sometimes when majority is changed either side that they get laid off, would this bill impact them?
And if you were a state worker, it would not impact them.
Okay. And so does this apply to just the DFL party?
This applies to any party affiliate that you are a member of.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if the previous witness would return for just a moment.
Well, Representative Clark.
Thank you. So I think earlier the author was talking about seasonal employees that may or may not be
eligible. Can you describe to me or tell me which type of seasonal employees are available or are being covered or are not being covered?
Yes. Both?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, by and large, seasonal and temporary employees do not really access benefits and wouldn't really be eligible for the program. However, if there is a rare circumstance, in some cases, a construction worker could be laid off not due to the seasonal condition, that individual would be eligible for the program so long as he or she is eligible for the unemployment insurance benefits. Based on federal and state statutes, we follow the unemployment insurance determination to deem eligibility for the dislocated worker program. Additionally, there are some cases in which individuals would be, have been laid off from employers who were not required to pay into the unemployment insurance fund, and therefore those workers would not be eligible for unemployment insurance. However, we would handle those eligibility cases on a case-by-case basis, and we could serve them in the dislocated worker program. So individuals employed by, for example, churches would not be eligible for UI benefits, but we could serve them with the dislocated worker program.
So what about seasonal workers due to the weather? You mentioned construction, landscapers, people working on some of the agricultural industries. Mm-hmm. Are they eligible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, my understanding, they typically are not eligible for the dislocated worker program.
So how can we hear you?
They typically are not eligible for the dislocated worker program. Okay.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier author here, we try to identify winners and losers again. Just wondering if any of the partisan staff would like to come up and weigh in on this one. That's a rhetorical question.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can retract the question if it's already been answered. I had a bill up in another committee. Have we talked about TAA?
Yeah. No, we have not talked about
okay, it. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question would be, this is a program that would potentially be considered a state supplement for very similar to covering workers who might not have been in a situation that was covered under TAA. And having dealt with quite a few of these cases recently, I have an understanding that on a federal level, the current administration is looking at eliminating TAA. And would this leave sufficient funds to handle, say, a mine layoff or something like that if it were used for all these other purposes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Metza, members of the committee, the state, so Minnesota is unique in the country in that we offer a state-funded dislocated worker program in addition to a federally funded dislocated worker program. We serve about three times as many individuals with state funds as with federal funds. Therefore, should the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program be eliminated, we would have resources to serve those workers impacted by trade as they would qualify for the dislocated worker program. The benefits may not be as generous as they are currently under the federally funded program, but we would be able to work with those workers. And to address your question possibly regarding eligibility criteria, there are a few instances in which an individual would be eligible for the state-funded dislocated worker program because we have that catch-all clause about trade adjustment assistance, whereas for the federally funded program, they may not technically be eligible for the federally funded dislocated worker program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my point kind of is, you know, we've got an administration now that's looking at eliminating what is a very good program that I have many, many, many constituents on right now, Representative Lehman does as well. And they're currently qualified for up to 2 years of job retraining, completely paid, and other services when they're laid off through no fault of their own. And in my mind, this is a program not designed to handle in mass those with the amount of funding the state is currently putting in. So if we had a layoff, I guess more specifically, that were equivalent to the downturn that we're just coming out of, and everyone, say TAA is no longer there, would this program be able to sustain just one mining layoff with the current funding that we give in a biennium?
So, Representative Metza, we have gone so far afield of this bill, I'm trying to figure out, can you just tell me how it's related in any tangential way to the Fenton bill?
Because this opens up, Mr. Chair, because this opens up many other facets of folks to qualify, and I think that overall it is relevant when we're talking about eliminating a program that's meant to take care of folks who lost their job for no fault of their own.
But what's the, this, so you can ask the question in a second, but how is it related to trade assistance? Do we have people, political workers on campaigns losing their jobs because of foreign trade, unfair foreign trade acts? What is the, how is this related to it? Representative Metza.
I'm not talking about the political workers. I'm talking about the original design of the dislocated worker program and how it's worked in conjunction historically with other programs that were in place and why we originally built this program more so on a historical level than the current proposal.
To the testifier and then to Representative Fenton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the program as a whole would certainly continue to serve individuals impacted by trade and dislocated workers. We offer one-on-one career counseling, assessments, support services, and job training. Those are our primary benefits. Again, we wouldn't be able to sustain the same level of funding for the long-term training that we've experienced in Northeast Minnesota with the mining layoffs. But the state-funded dislocated worker program would be able to serve those workers, provided they had that attachment to the labor force and the eligibility, of course, for unemployment insurance and so on. So,
Representative Fenn.
I'm just going to restate. I'm trying to preserve the integrity of this program, but clarify that campaign staffers do not qualify.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's it.
Representative Howe, then Mahoney, then Moran.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, I appreciate you finally getting to my question as far as what the heck TAA stood for, because I was clueless. So I'm glad that was answered. But the other question I have then is, what's the maximum benefit amount that someone collects off of something like this?
Ms. Welch?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, members of the committee, when you say something like this, do you mean the state-funded dislocated worker program or...
Mr. Chair. Yes.
Sure. We operate the program very responsibly in that we typically spend right around $2,150 per participant per year. The Trade Adjustment Assistance Program is a benefit in addition to that, and we have caps in place, but it really depends on the costs of training, because when individuals lose their jobs to trade, the jobs are gone, so people really need full retraining, up to 2 years of full training. So we'd spend, $9,000, $10,000 in some cases. Our cap would be $15,000 per person.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the Executive Director of the Workforce, what's your definition of a temporary worker?
Ms. Welch.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, temporary worker, we have an eligibility policy we abide by. It would typically mean if an individual took a job that did not endure beyond 6 months. I actually would prefer... my definition is different, I think, than what we use for programmatic eligibility. Again, for eligibility for the dislocated worker program, we really rely on those unemployment insurance benefits.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Fenton, do political campaigns, whether they're DFL or GOP, do they pay unemployment insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney.
No, that was a question for Representative Fenton.
Representative Fenton.
They typically do.
In your work for the Republican Party, did you pay workers' comp?
Representative Fenton.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton, in your work, and I'm trying, I'm going back to your comments about having worked for the party. When you hired trackers or staff or whatever, did you, even if it was for a campaign, did they typically work longer than 6 months?
Representative Fenton?
Not really.
Representative Mahoney?
But again, I did say in our contracts there was a clause identifying that the job was a temporary job.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in your comments, you actually, the inflection in your voice was that these workers not only had the opportunity to, but did take advantage of rents and mortgage issues and retraining. Do you know if any of these particular people that were laid off after the election took advantage of rents? Rent assistance, or mortgage assistance, or job retraining assistance?
Representative Fenton.
That would be a question for those administering the program. What happened was, for the first time, 50 to 60 staffers banded together to form a group to use the program. To have the status of victims of mass layoff. Now, this program is available to layoffs of 50 or more. So these staffers would have to form that group to get up to that number. And as far as administering and I would ask for the administrator of the program to answer that question.
So, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Welch, did you have any information on if anyone in this class accessed these benefits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, members of the committee, we did set up a mass layoff project with the number 50 in mind, given that we reached out to House and Senate staff, DFL staff, RNC staff. 70 DFL staff and 100 Senate staff were identified as interested in that program, so we surveyed their needs. We set up a grant in the amount of $225,000 to serve up to 50 workers. However, only two individuals actually enrolled in the program. So what we've done is basically canceled that grant. It's returned back to the workforce. We funded it out of federal money. We've returned that back to our federal budget, and we're serving those two individuals using funds for individuals impacted by small layoffs, because we do not need that magic number of 50 to serve all dislocated workers. The program can serve people impacted by any size layoff.
Representative Mahoney, good enough?
Then I will make a comment. I don't know if we're done here or not, but we're going through this exercise, and you are cutting – and we are cutting off employment assistance because two people asked for help. I have to tell you that the idea of creating a law for two people is ridiculous, but the idea that we help two people find a job a little faster is a good thing.
Chair would like a roll call on the vote, so we're going to roll call this thing. Representative Moran, May Quaid, and Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fenton, which is a new question that's in response to a statement that a group of workers band together to form a group. Could you talk a little bit more about that and how you know?
Ms. Welch, can you explain that process?
No, with Representative Fenton.
Well, I'm going to ask the expert representative.
Right?
Ms. Welch.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the committee. When we learn about mass layoffs, and we learn about them through any variety of ways, we reach out to the impacted workers. We reach out to their employers. The employers give us a description of what led to the layoff. We connect with the workers, and we actually survey them to determine what kinds of needs they have and what kind of interests we see in the program. If we reach that 50 mark for individuals who are expressing interest in the program. We operate a competitive process to award a mass layoff project. And by that competitive process, it puts the workers in the driver's seat. They get to choose who their service provider will be. We have 16 workforce development areas throughout the state, which encompass 48 workforce centers. And in addition, we have 8 individual service providers who can offer these services to these dislocated workers. The difference between services to an individual impacted by a small layoff and services to individuals impacted by mass layoffs is the dedication of funding. So when we have a group of 50 or more submitting surveys, we can set up that dedicated grant to ensure all of those workers are served. That typically helps to stabilize the economic impact of whatever layoff is happening. For those impacted by the smaller layoffs, they are, in a sense, competing against a lot of other individuals impacted by small layoffs for resources at the workforce centers or independent service providers.
Thank you for that information. So they didn't really band together. You reached out to the employer. Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, they did reach out to us, and in that effort, it's kind of a mutual outreach. So we have a team of 7 rapid responders who are both receiving calls from and reaching out to impacted workers.
Yeah. It's a common, seems like a common practice or something they can do. And so I don't really have a question, but a statement that I'm trying to understand, you know, when someone is working and it's a job, whether they for a party or whatever, it is work that is helping them to feed their family or pay bills or whatever they need to do, you know, to be self-sufficient. And I can't quite understand why we're targeting, you know, campaign workers. It's a job, you know. And why, I mean, we've created a process for people who are in the workforce to receive type of support that is needed for them. And it's just, you know, whether it's 50 people who receive, you know, benefits or the 2 that decided to take advantage of the law the way it is a good thing. It's okay. And so I just think it's really unfortunate that we are targeting, you know, campaign workers for doing a job that they were hired to do.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, in the words of the DEET, the DW program excludes temporary seasonal workers. I see it as a season, campaign season. Everybody uses it in that knowledge. I see a campaign staffer similar to a Christmas tree lot worker. That Christmas tree lot worker knows that his job ends with Christmas, and a campaign staffer knows. At the end of a campaign, there are wins and there are losses, but if you want to go further and have a job after that, you have to interview with following the candidate into the designated area where they're going. There's a win or a loss at the end of a campaign, not it's not a full-time job. It's a seasonal employment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
But just because, Representative Vincent, you see it that way, doesn't mean that they cannot take advantage of the law that provides them the opportunity to receive workers. right? Dislocated workers' benefits. Right?
Well, indeed agrees that seasonal and temporary workers are excluded.
Okay, thank you.
Representative McQuaid will be back. Representative Metza again and Clark again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess historically, and I'll be short here, this is a one question, President Trump just launched a campaign. And the way I look at it, it's 4 years in advance. For a little less than 4 years in advance of running for office, would it entail all those types of employees? Is that your intent to get anyone who works for a campaign period off, or just lower-level staff?
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's campaign staff. It's anybody is defined under statute 10A under campaign finance.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just clarification would be anyone, a state director included, would not qualify for this if they were looking for other work after their chosen party ran for, say, 3 or 4 years they were working for an organization. They would no longer qualify for this benefit for retraining.
Representative Fenton.
If they fall under 10A, no.
Okay. Thank you.
If you're employed by the state of Minnesota, yes, you would qualify.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, did the workers that we're talking about here pay the assessment up to the Worker Development Fund, the special $32 approximately fee for the Worker Fund? That's my question. Are they paying for that fund when they're employed?
Ms. Welch, do these employees pay the Workforce Development fee?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is that all employers who pay into the unemployment insurance fund also pay into the workforce development fund. So, yes.
So, Mr. Chairman, people are collecting on a fund that their employer has paid into to get retraining after job loss. Is that, a good summary of what the workforce development fund pays for?
Well,
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, yes.
Representative Clark.
So, Representative Fenton, your party or my party or anybody else's party are paying a special fee. They're not just, isn't that something people are getting as a special privilege? The organization is paying a fee to entitle the persons to get retraining. Do you understand that that's the situation, or do you think you can test that or swing at some other mechanism?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that. And again, please get the Department of Deeds report and read it. To be eligible for the DW program, an individual typically must qualify for UI. For the DW program excludes temporary seasonal workers, however, who make up a large portion of the UI recipients. So many seasonal and temporary workers are also paying, we're all paying into this, to this program.
Representative Clark.
So, Madam Chair, to our staff person, you indicated there are some exceptions. I think you talked about church workers, and I don't know what other else. But folks who, do they not pay into the, is that why, well, we'll just ask you, do they pay the special fee for the Disability Worker Fund or not?
Ms. Welch.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The employers who are excluded from needing to pay into the unemployment insurance fund are also excluded from needing to pay into the workforce development fund. It really depends on the status of the workers. So the workers need to qualify with a certain wage that they earn so that those employers pay in. However, those who are exempt from the unemployment insurance rules are also exempt from the workforce development fund rules, is my understanding.
I just want to clarify again from the staff person.
The CEO, I'm sorry.
Are there exceptions then when seasonal workers are eligible if their employers have been paying into the Dislocated Worker Fund?
Ms. Welch.
If seasonal or temporary workers are deemed eligible for unemployment insurance, which we allow our agency's unemployment insurance division to then make that judgment call, we would honor that eligibility in the dislocated worker program as well. So there would be exceptions.
So Mr. Chairman, is that what happened in this case?
My apologies, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. The workers impacted by this layoff were eligible for unemployment insurance. So there was really no question of their, in most cases, no question of their eligibility. The only concern we might run into is if they didn't have a long enough attachment to the labor force, which that really wasn't a concern as well for most of those workers. That's the logic that we follow for our program operations.
Representative Clark.
So, Mr. Chairman, it sounds like these folks were eligible under the law, and there's no reason why they should not be
eligible for retraining, just as any other worker who is described, as you described, would be covered. I guess I'm trying to understand why this bill is before us. I know you keep pointing, Representative Fenton, to seasonal workers, but we just heard that seasonal workers who are paying into this fund are eligible. So it's a real particular target that you're making rather than, you know, saying seasonal workers are not eligible because in this case they are.
Ms. Welch, do you want to comment on that?
Well, certainly, perhaps the distinguishing factor in our annual report, we would make the statement about the seasonal and temporary workers because it could be related then to their attachment to the labor force. For people who work 4 months out of the year, they would not meet our criteria of having worked six of the last 36 months for eligibility criteria. But other than that, I mean, they would have been eligible. So,
So the determination of whether they pay UI taxes or not, do you make that before they're an employee or after they're an employee?
No. Well, our division doesn't really make that determination. It's made under the law.
But
right?
Before we know if an employee qualifies or not, they have to. We don't know that prospectively. We know it reactively after they've worked a certain length. Correct.
Yes.
So by definition, there are people who pay this tax who are not eligible for benefits. Because not everyone who pays the tax ends up qualifying.
The employer would pay in, Mr. Chair, the employer would pay in, and we're actually treading into territory that I don't feel comfortable answering questions about. So,
welcome to the legislature. Representative Clark, do you have any closing comments?
Just a question. I think I want to just be clear.
Representative Clark, is this your last question, or are we going to have more questions?
I think it can be the last one.
Can it be, or will it be?
What do you prefer, Mr. Chairman?
I definitely want it to be the last one.
It'll be the last one, then.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll definitely do that. Is it true, then, that anyone who worked 4 months or less from this group that we're talking about here that are the target of this particular bill would have been excluded already. So we would not need this legislation because they already would have been excluded according to the requirements of seasonal employment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, yes, that is correct. And don't quote me on the 4 months, but largely, yes, that is correct.
Does any other member of the committee wish to beat this dead horse? Does it make weight here or not?
Nope.
The chair withdraws his request for a roll call. Any closing comments, Representative Fenton?
No. Thank you for the time, members, and a good discussion.
With that, Representative Neuberger renews his motion to have House File 1394 recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. No, motion no. Prevails. The bill is on the General Register. Thank you, Representative Fenton. Representative Nash. Representative Makeway does not move. Representative Metza moves House File 1944. Be recommended to pass and refer to taxes. Representative Nash, do you have a author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having me in today. I have a DE2 amendment to put the bill in the shape that I would like.
The author moves the DE2 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The bill is now in the form it's like. Representative Nash, are any of the other amendments yours?
No, Mr. Chair, they are not.
Okay, so Representative Nash will go to your presentation. We'll take up the amendments at the completion of your presentation. Representative Nash.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah. House File 1944 is a bill to honor the idea of working hard with your hands and to help high school students begin to understand and possibly achieve that. You know, I'm the parent of six kids, and the law of large numbers says that one of them is probably not going to want to go to college, and I want to make sure that they understand that as their dad, as a legislator, as a lawmaker here in the state of Minnesota, that I honor that, and I want them to find that pathway early on. As somebody who's been in the community for a very long time, when I was mayor and city council member, I had lots of business owners say, Jim, we can't find good workers. We wish that we had a way to work with local businesses to get them turned on, get high school students exposed, turned on, mentored, and apprenticed so that one day they may choose to work in the trades. And, Mr. Chair, that is the intent of this bill. There are some things in here that I think are
are different than things we've seen in the past. We're trying to let local businesses know that we're making an investment in them so that they can mentor and keep safe the students that are going to be eventually in their charge. And in the essence of brevity, Mr. Chair, since I read Chair Garofalo's face quite fluently, I will slow down and be quiet now. I do have some testifiers, and I know you have some other amendments that may be offered.
We have two invited testifiers. Do they wish to testify this time? No? Joshua Makaros? Kyle Makaros, I'm sorry. And Don Mullen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Getsky. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Builders Exchange and a proud resident of Eagan. I'm here today in support of any effort on behalf of the commercial construction industry in Minnesota to help get the word out to young people, male, female, all races, to get into and start working in the commercial or residential, the building industry in short. We have been working in the construction industry for a couple of years to help amplify the need to raise awareness with young people on the valuable careers that stand ready for them in the construction industry. We're trying to ensure a steady flow of construction workers and qualified laborers, and we're trying to spread the word, especially among high school people, about lifelong careers in construction. So in short, I'm really here to support any or all resources and programs that will help ramp up the efforts to get the message directly to high school students and especially to their parents about the great careers that are ready to be filled by them. It's their choice, and we want them to think about working for a lifelong career in the construction industry. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Makaros?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please say your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Joshua Kyle Makaros, as you well know, with Carpenters Union. Mr. Mullen is not going to testify today, but I appreciate the opportunity to appear before your committee. First, I'd like to say that I enthusiastically agree with the underlying premise of Representative Nash's bill, that we need new, innovative ways to get young people excited about rewarding careers in the construction industry. I also greatly appreciate the improvements that Representative Nash is making to his bill with his delete all amendments. This is a big move in the right direction and alleviates the main concerns that we raised with Representative Nash. We greatly appreciate that movement, and we're going to continue to work with Representative Nash if there's a couple more wrinkles to iron out as we move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Makaros. This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, Amy Wallstein with the Minnesota Precision Manufacturers Association. Just a quick word on the delete all amendment and connect me on a couple dots. With Representative Nash's VPSEO bill, we took a look at that and we really realized a lot of what he was looking to do was very similar to what Representative Rarick had proposed in House File 631, which we discussed in committee last week. So we took a look at how to sync those two pieces up, and that's the piece before you today. So MPMA supports efforts to strengthen the skilled workforce, and we think that the combination of the youth skills program with the incentives from House File 1944 are a powerful combination to improve our skilled workforce. Thank you.
Are there any other members of the public which testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion, move to members' questions. Members, we have amendments that are labeled the A1 through A8 amendments. Is there anyone who wishes to offer any of those amendments at this time? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A6.
Okay. And Representative Mahoney, as I'm looking here, this is referencing page 3, line 12, but there's no longer a page 3, line 12 on the bill.
I'll ask staff to make adjustments as it goes on.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
I would suspect everybody in this particular, all of these amendments, they'll have to make a small oral amendment. So on my amendment here, the line 1.3, It says program must supervise apprentices. Apprentices needs to be changed to the student learner, I think, is in the bill. Student learner.
Ms. Walstein.
Mr. Chair, I would accept this as a friendly amendment.
Okay.
Representative Mahoney and I have spoken, and this is a friendly amendment.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A6 amendment is adopted. Representative Mahoney, do you have any other amendments you wish to offer?
Well, I think Representative Sundin has one, and I think Representative Moran has one.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A7. And I also have a similar oral amendment for that on line 1.3. After all, the word apprentices should be stricken, and then insert student learner.
So, and again, assuming Representative Sundin, your goal is to, the direction of staff is to make adjustments as necessary to fit to the intent of the author.
Correct.
Representative Sundin incorporates that oral amendment into his amendment. Representative Sundin.
On this amendment, it actually provides for some basic training, OSHA 10, which is a very basic safety knowledge that should be ingrained in any person going on a construction site and quite possibly on a production floor as well. So it just gives a basic knowledge there so they're not a danger to themselves or others.
Representative Nash, the A7 amendment is amended.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Sundin. I'm a dad of 6 kids. I want them to be safe. This is a completely friendly amendment.
Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Is there any other amendments that wish to be offered?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
I will offer the A5 amendment.
Representative Moran, there's the A5 amendment. And Representative Moran, my guess is your intent is to once again, direct staff to conform this to the language of the delete all amendments, so there is no page line 3, line 12, so I'll make that amendment for you. Senator Moran.
So the oral amendment would be for the apprentice to be a student learner, but also for women. And if we can amend that to girls instead of women,
so
if that makes
Senator
a difference.
Moran, you wish to change line 1.4 from women to girls?
Because this is high school students, right?
It's your amendment, Representative Moran. So you wish to change line 1.4 to from women to girls?
Yes.
Do you have any other changes you wish to incorporate into your amendment, Representative Moran? Right.
We're looking like girls, women.
Representative Moran?
All right. Thank you. So I've been this amendment before, and, you know, sometimes it's exhausting, you know, to have to carve out some intentionality in bills, but what we do know is that in the state of Minnesota, we have some of the highest disparity within the job workforce and education, and often enough, we don't have enough diverse populations of those who are being engaged in the process. So this amendment is a really simple amendment that says an employer participating in the program must demonstrate that it has engaged in the effort to recruit girls and people of color as student learners.
So you wish to strike line 1.4, apprentices, and replace with student learners?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rena, can we add in the word indigenous as well?
Absolutely. So additional oral amendment would be...
So, Senator Moran, you have 3 amendments to your amendment now?
Yes.
Okay, so your goal is to strike on line 1.4, strike women, replace with girls, strike apprentices, replace with student learners, and what is the second amendment?
And add to people of color and indigenous.
And so after people of color, you would add and indigenous?
Yes. And people.
And Representative Moran indigenous corporate.
People.
And indigenous people?
Yes.
Any other changes, Representative Moran?
That is it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Moran incorporates that into her amendment. Ms. Walstein, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the intent, and we talk about legislative intent here quite frequently, I have zero intentions of stratifying men, women, indigenous, not. I want students who are interested to feel comfortable to come forward and do this. And, you know, this is a fairly heavy moving parts, and I would, Mr. Chair, we're laying this over, correct?
No, you're sending it to taxes.
I
suppose you could accept the amendment, and then if there's any work out any discrepancies in the language of Representative Moran at taxes.
Representative.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I reflect the sentiments of the author. When we say must demonstrate, what's the penalty if we don't?
Representative
Moran. And what is the definition of demonstrate?
Representative Moran.
There is no penalty, but we want people, we want, I would hope that as we, as employers begin to recruit and investigate those who are interested, that we have a pool of diverse individuals within our school system who are being tied to the trainings, to the opportunities that lies before them. And often enough, you know, believe it or not, you know, often enough we don't see that diversity. So we're asking for an intent to create a pool of diverse student learners.
And
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Moran, how do I demonstrate? This is a small manufacturing company in Lancaster, Minnesota. And with all due respect to what you're trying to do, I understand that. And it's no fault of where I live. We don't have a lot of diversity in our populations.
Mr. Chair,
hold on,
well,
hold on, let Fabian finish.
Okay.
And I don't want to somehow have high school in Lancaster, Minnesota, be excluded from a program because they can't demonstrate that they are doing this. I have complete faith and confidence in the intention of the author and the schools and so forth that I represent, that they would have this open to all people just naturally. And I'm concerned that this is going to somehow exclude a school district possibly because we don't have the same situation that we have in many other parts of the state.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
So I would, in clear common sense response, that if you didn't have people of color in your district, there would be the probability that you probably could not find students of color. But in the poor cities like St. Paul and Minneapolis, it's more of a likelihood that we could. I don't have the faith that you have, unfortunately. But my hope is that, you know, I do believe in good intentions, but the hope is that we can put language in the bill that help to encourage people to seek a more diverse population of student learners. It's more of being inclusive. It's not so much about, you know, trying to create barriers or putting people in positions where they're going out of their way to try to include student learners who are not there in their town. And I hear your intent. And, you know, and this is nothing against the author of the bill, right? This is about rolling it out into communities and creating a pathway for student learners to have an opportunity.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash, here is the kind of the genesis of this particular amendment. There are now in many construction industries, in many of our manufacturers, there are requirements that they meet minority participation. I think this particular amendment could be worked on. Maybe the wording is not quite the way it's supposed to be. I hope you'd accept it, and as we move this bill forward through taxes and every place else, we can find a if anyone seems to be uncomfortable with the wording, we can find clearer wording for people.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief on this. Representative Moran, Representative Mahoney, if you read my bill, you understand that I've taken great lengths to be very inclusive and very accepting. I want to make sure that this amendment is tight before we take it on, and I would give you my word, and Representative Moran, I think you know that my word is good with you. I will work with you to make this amendment something that I think that we can come to an agreement on. If you would be willing to withdraw, I will guarantee you I'll work with you before it hits taxes.
Linda Moran.
I would take that as a yes.
So you?
I am willing to work with you, and I withdraw the amendment.
Thank you. Are there any other members who wish to offer any other amendments? Any closing discussion? Representative Nash, you get the final word. Representative Sundin, my apologies.
Mr. Nash, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash, I just did some quick math on this. At 10 hours a week for 8 weeks would be the time served there. I'm just wondering if you've entertained the thought of one of these young men, women, jumping into a volunteer program such as Habitat for Humanity. Very rewarding work, and they've got projects going constantly. I don't know if they qualify as an employer, but if there's $2,000 on the table for them and they could pay a worker $12.50 an hour and take the other $12.50 an hour to cover the insurance costs, that type of thing, that would be rewarding work for a young person as well. So just a thought I'd like to share with you.
Representative Sundin, thank you so much. I think this could go a lot of different ways, and we should encourage folks to do just that. And Mr. Chair, in closing, this is something that I appreciate many of you who are on this committee being co-authors with. I appreciate the work with me. This is a vision that I have had for some time. I'm excited by it. I think that it says to folks who work in the trades, we value you. It reminds me of a buddy I went to high school with that took every shop class he possibly could, and we always wondered, well, what's Lon going to do when he gets to college? Well, Lon now owns an earth-moving company, and he's worth about $900 million. I want more Lons coming out of Minnesota. I want folks to understand that there are great jobs and great careers and a great amount of money that can be made, and I want to be able to get to them earlier so that they can understand that there's value and honor with working with your hands. So, Mr. Chair, thank you so much.
With that, Representative Metzler renews his motion. I have House File 1944 is amended, recommended to pass, and referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. You're on your way to taxes. Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Vogel. Representative Vogel moves that House File 1001 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1001 deals with regulation in the housing industry. And the reason I'm before you is because there's become a problem with affordability, and as we look at the number of people that are getting into especially new houses nowadays, it's really difficult for them. And one of the major cost drivers, unfortunately, has been regulation. And that's not to say that regulation is wrong or bad. It's just that cumulatively, regulations are starting to drive up the price of the house that makes it unaffordable. So what this bill does is to say that if there's going to be new regulation over $1,000, that it has to be reported to the legislature and approved before it can go into effect. And I know there will be some discussion relative to that being an infringement on regulatory bodies being able to put new things in place. But I'd like you to also, as we discuss this, listen to some of the drivers that are going into the cost of a new home, as well as this also addresses remodeling, so that we can keep homes affordable. You know, we're driving up now the average cost of the house well over $250,000, and that puts probably 50 to 60% of the market, or the populace, out of the marketplace for being able to get into a new house. And the other thing that's happening in the remodeling industry is with some of the regulations, it's making it difficult for them to take an existing house, remodel it, and make it affordable. So this is looking at the lower income spectrum of the marketplace, more so than the higher income, I guess, because some of those people can probably afford a little more, as well as first-time home buyers to get them into a home so that they can hopefully move on an apartment and create some equity for their family. And with that, I've got some testifiers, Mr. Chair, if I could, and have them explain more of the nuances of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Dave Siegel, and I'm the Executive Director of the Builders Association of the Twin Cities in support of House File 1001. The housing industry supports this bill because it allows the legislature to exercise its proper and rightful role for regulatory oversight. I think it's important to note that this is not an effort to diminish the resource protections or the safety elements that are advanced by the various regulations affecting our industry. Frankly, Batsy agrees with most of the housing regulations, and we have tremendous respect for the professionals that implement those regulations and manage and implement those various rules and regulations. But we have reached a point in our industry for our homeowners where the accumulation of rules and regulations and fees are creating a substantial detrimental impact, an overwhelming cost for Minnesota families in our housing market. So some of you may say, why is this needed? Our industry seeks to build safe, durable homes at a price that families can afford. And similarly, our codes call for the creation of uniform and affordable safety standards. And in practice, what we find is that the affordability measure for homeowners is often the piece that gets forgotten or left out. Recent housing regulations, for example, have come from five individual rulemaking bodies across three separate state agencies. And really, those agencies don't look at each other's actions. And perhaps they shouldn't. But somebody needs to do that. And that's why we're here with this piece of legislation before you. As you might imagine, our first-time home buyers and buyers in the lower price points are the most heavily affected by these increasing regulatory costs. And they're also having a negative effect on our housing market. We lag in building at the entry-level price point in Minnesota, and our rate of recovery since the crash is slower than our sister cities across the Midwest. We also lack a healthy price point distribution in our market, and I can illustrate that by just a couple quick facts. A decade ago, 70% of the homes that we built were under $350,000, and today 70% of the homes that we build are over $350,000. Only 30% are below that $350,000 mark on new construction. This is really problematic for prospective homeowners. We aim to build for the market, and the largest concentration of buyers is, frankly, at the lower price points. Our builders would like to build for that segment of the market. And there certainly are other factors that impact this lack of affordable housing, such as land and labor costs, but I have to say that regulatory impact and regulatory surge is unquestionably one of the largest and most significant parts of it. These rulemaking processes include Wetland Conservation Act, construction stormwater permit, building code, energy code, plumbing code, electrical code. These are all examples of rules that impact housing. And we do have confidence in the technical expertise of these agencies and their rulemaking processes, but what we don't see is the collective assessment of the impact of all these rules, the aggregated impact of these, and the impact that they're having on affordability. So some have asked if this is a response to the strength rule that's been discussed at length over the last 5 years. Just have to tell you that the reality is that the sprinkler mandate was but one of dozens of mandates across multiple rulemaking processes in the recent past that have impacted costs for families. I will say new and newly built homes in Minnesota are among the best built homes in the country, and we should be very proud of that. We aim to build that safe, durable home at a price that families can afford. We've achieved the safety, we've achieved the durability, but the affordability piece is often overlooked. And we think House File 1001 will bring that element into consideration, and so we ask for your support today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Weiner. I'm a home builder, land developer, and realtor. My home building company is Cardinal Home Builders. Cardinal's been building homes for over 50 years. And mainly in the East Metro area. I also serve as the Builder Vice President of the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. As a builder for several decades, I can tell you that the recent acceleration of regulatory rules and requirements has had a major impact on our industry and ultimately on my ability to build affordable homes. I have developments today where I am struggling to build at a price point that home buyers can afford. An example of this is a small infill development that I have in North St. Paul. These twin homes aim to fill an important market segment as an affordable option for downsizing families. This has been difficult due to various regulations to stormwater rules, building code, energy code. In the case of these twin homes, the sprinkler systems that cost between $6,000 and $7,000 per unit. We've tried to fill a market need based on the past customer requests with an aging-in-place option, where the homeowners sell their existing homes to downsize, and then they live in the same community close to their friends, family, shopping, and churches. Most first-rent communities don't have the existing homes to meet these demands. We have two of these infill developments under construction now and have had a difficult time making the price affordable based on the existing market values in these communities. We have had plumbing code changes, energy code changes, electrical code changes, heating code changes, and in the case of our twin homes, the sprinklers that have increased our costs by over $12,000 in the last 2 years, and let alone our normal cost increases. We know that for every time we raise the cost of a home by $1,000, 4,000 Minnesota families will be priced out of the market. And just 5 years ago, the average regulatory cost in a new single-family home was $65,000. Today, that number is $84,000 on average, a 30% increase over the last 5 years. And when we price a home, 25% of the final price is related to regulation. I know that some of these are necessary to the health and safety of our buyers. However, we do need to realize that we are pricing new homes out of range for a majority of Minnesotans. As a home builder building homes for families, I'm hoping that the legislature will bring the affordability perspective to rulemaking to be sure that we have the right balance. Thank you.
Representative Vogel, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion. Is someone coming down to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm the state building official and director of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division of Department of Labor and Industry. I'm here this afternoon representing the department to speak against House File 1001. At the outset, however, I would like to say that the department supports efforts to promote more affordable housing. However, there are three reasons why we don't support this particular approach. First, we believe the change is not necessary. Our current statutory charge states that the construction of buildings should be permitted at the least possible cost consistent with recognized standards of health and safety. Those are the current charges that we operate under. I have been doing this for 30 years for the state of Minnesota, and without exception, we have always partnered and sat down with our friends from the home building industry when adopting new codes. It's frankly a lot of work that we do perform every 6 years that neither staff particularly enjoy, because it's a lot of work piling through a lot of complex technical code issues. But when the time comes, our joint staffs work together collaboratively to produce new codes that we believe are balancing both the need for public safety with cost and affordability. Second, it will delay the implementation of new codes. In 2015, the home builders helped pass a new law that requires the department to adopt new codes within 2 years. And debating specific costs or having a legislative committee decide that a rule shouldn't be adopted will prolong an already very lengthy rulemaking process and seriously risk our ability to be able to meet this 2-year deadline. And frankly, one of the reasons the builders want new codes adopted as soon as possible is because after waiting 6 years, they're anxious to get many of the new provisions, which bring clarity and relaxed provisions, into the new code to enable new technologies and reduce costs in many instances. And thirdly, I would advocate that the building code isn't really the problem here. The cost of doing business in residential construction includes the very high cost of land, particularly anywhere around the Twin Cities area, labor costs, and all of the development and city environmental regulations, most of which really have little to do with the building code. And surprisingly, today's homeowners are the ones that significantly contribute to the increased price point, as most of them do not want a basic affordable home. They want granite and nice fixtures, appliances, hardwood floors, panel doors, etc. That's what today's homeowners are expecting. In reality, the biggest contributors to the increased cost of the building code in the last 10 years have been in radon, window fall protection, and, frankly, the energy code. And of those, both radon and window fall requirements were added to the code as charged by legislation, so the agency had no choice in the matter. And the energy code that we did adopt in 2015 was, we were obligated to adopt by the federal government as a condition of receiving money for the American Reinvestment Act funds back in that day. So just in closing, I just, you know, today's homeowners do expect that the codes that they enforce on their homes, the largest investment they'll likely ever make, they are expecting that their home is going to be quality, safe, dry, energy efficient, and durable, and if they have concerns, we learn about it. And up to this point, it's been our agency's delegated responsibility to ensure that the code accomplishes that, and frankly does so as cost-effectively as possible. So with that, I'd be happy to answer or address any questions.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member comments and questions. Questions from members of the committee. Representative Wagenius? Yes. Representative New?
Or Representative Wagenius? Mr. Chair, for the testifier, you folks, before you mentioned the energy code, you mentioned the energy code. And I'm sitting here thinking about for energy in particular, if you add this much extra insulation to your home, then it will go into your mortgage, but your payback in heating costs may be dramatic. And so I worry that we are substituting upfront later costs for upfront costs. So tell me how you all deal with that particular issue.
Representative Gaines, who's the question for?
Pardon?
Who is the question for?
Our current testifier.
Mr. McClellan.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The Department of Energy actually did an independent analysis of Minnesota's energy code and determined that there would be a 5.7-year payback for those energy improvements with an average cost, annual cost savings of just under $700 a year. Now, again, and the actual cost to implement the energy code provisions, we estimated approximately 75 cents to a dollar a square foot based on the size of the home. But there is a relatively quick payback on those improvements.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you. I think as we discuss this, that's critical because if we're talking about affordability, paying extra for years and years and years and years because you don't have enough insulation is not affordable. So it would be helpful if you would share some of the figures that you just recited to the committee.
To the testifier.
In writing.
Okay.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. McClellan as well. You indicated that you do a pretty extensive review of the individual codes. So my question is, you know, there are a lot of codes under your jurisdiction, building codes, electrical codes, plumbing codes, etc. How do you specifically account for the cumulative costs of all of those individual codes? Because I understand you review them individually, but how do you account for that cumulative cost? Because that's really the concern here. Any individual cost is not nearly the concern as the cumulative cost.
Certainly.
To the testifier.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a good question. We have separate rulemakings for the building code, for the mechanical code, electrical code, and individually we're obligated by the rulemaking process to assess what the financial impact is on those codes, and we do that in a very detailed manner. But they are individual rulemaking. So one may indicate a certain cost level, and yet when the electrical code is adopted, that may have a separate cost impact. So you are correct. There's no one that's overseeing or reviewing those in totalitary or other environmental regulations. Correct.
Members, just a point of information. We have a hard stop in about 4 minutes, and we've got three people lined up this 10 minutes. Sorry, we got 10 minutes, three people. So just keep that in mind, please. Representative New.
So just to clarify, there is no mechanism in place for accounting for those cumulative costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, correct, at least not from our agency perspective, yes.
Or savings.
Representative Mayquaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This could be, I'm not sure who this is for, just so I can understand how many times, if this bill passes, the committee could expect to see, have us review this. How many times in the last cycle, 6 years, 3 years, would this have been triggered if this bill was law?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I understand you, you're asking how many times would our evaluation of the $1,000 have been triggered? Is that what you asked?
Representative Naquaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm just trying to get a sense of how many times would we have to review, how many rules would have triggered this in the last 6 years, 3 years, however many times this has been changed.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have, as it affects the residential realm, there are 11 different codes from residential, mechanical, electrical, plumbing that could impact residential construction. 11 different chapters of Minnesota rule that could be affected.
Representative Naquaid, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. So in the last 6 years, of those 11 different chapters, how many rules have been changed that would have cost over $1,000 mm-hmm. that we would have had to then review if this law had been passed at the time?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a very good question. Probably the easiest one is just the one that we did in 2015, to my recollection. Normally, in the cycle of adopting a new residential building code, frankly, there aren't many changes. Maybe some additional smoke detector locations or wall bracing or shingle requirements, very rarely. This last cycle, for example, there was a provision that required sheetrock on the bottom side of trusses over unfinished basements. That was probably the most prominent potential code change. Now, builders have a choice. They could use 2x10 construction and not have to sheetrock it. Or if they went with engineered trusses, the fire service has been lobbying for years to protect firefighters from falling through floors. So we did put that provision in the code. Depending what kind of what contractor you ask, that could range from 50 cents a square foot to $1.25 a square foot. Hence the complexity in determining value depending who's bidding the job. Depending how big the basement is, that will determine whether that's over $1,000 or not.
Representative Naquaid, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. And this might be for the building trades. So I'm not a homeowner. And just to be very clear, the reason I'm not a homeowner is not because of regulations. It's because I'm poor and probably will be for a long time. It takes a lot of money to save up to buy a house. The $1,000 is not the factor. But can you give me an example of what we could trade for lower costs? So we talked about plumbing, heating, energy, water, wasteland. Could someone give me an example of things that we could trade in terms of protections or codes for lower costs? I just don't own a house, and so I don't know.
That's fair.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we deal with minimum standards. So our codes generally are established as minimum safety standards. So I would not be in a position to say that some of those could be taken out. There have been advocates that said if we install residential sprinklers, such as the sheetrock I referred to, that could come off. But then you're trading one set of costs for another set of construction. So there may be other things in the infrastructure, but the homeowners, as much as anything, drive up what those finishes look like and what the cost is.
So, members, here's the deal. I've gotten permission from bipartisan support from Representative Saki and Representative Hamilton, who have testifiers who are from out of town, and I asked them, am I supposed to move fast? And they said yes, because out of respect to their testifiers. So if you got something to say, you better hurry up and say it, and if it's a question, it better be really quick. Representative Sundin.
Does this affect local codes in any way?
The testifier.
What type of codes? I'm
local
sorry.
Codes.
Local codes? No, Representative. This is Thank the you. State building code.
Thank you. Yes. Representative Mahoney.
It's hard to be quick when we're dealing with a bill like this because you've got either or in here, so you've got either the House or the Senate actually comes up with any objections. You stop the code. you're going to have a dozen different items that are going to come to this legislature. Is what's the cost of putting in a GFI in any place that you put water? What's the cost of going with a higher? This is a bill that is just looking for problems. But the nice part is we can go back to having good fights on the House floor over building codes. I remember some of those.
Representative Vogel, any closing comments?
I'm just trying to prepare for the House floor, I guess.
With that, Representative Vogel renews his motion to have House File 1001 recommend to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. You're on your way to the General Register. Thank you. Representative Hamilton, do you have someone to move your bill, Representative Hamilton?
Please, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I'll move it.
Representative Moran moves House File 2167 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Hamilton, it would be ironic if you waited that whole time and you did not have anyone to move your bill. But Representative Hamilton, your bill.
Mr. Chairman, could I please turn it over to the testifiers at this time?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Bota Urabe, Director for the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. I'm here today, and I want to start off by just sharing a bit about my background because I think it has relevance in this bill. I've had over 20 years of experience in the nonprofit and sector, having served as executive director of both local and national nonprofits. Today, the work of the coalition is we bring nearly 600 Asian American leaders from throughout the state who work in the nonprofit, private, and public sectors who come together to work on issues that improves the lives of community. In addition to bringing leaders together, we actively collaborate with partners and organizations who work throughout the state of Minnesota to make sure that our communities are vibrant and thriving for all people. You will see that this bill has broad support if you look at your handout with over 35 organizations who've signed on to support it from various communities who work throughout the state. Today we have 20 supporters, a few have left, but they represent different communities and are here because they think this is extremely important. Our partners, supporters, and I are here to discuss the significance of House File 2167, the Nonprofit Infrastructure, Workforce Development, and Partnerships Program. This bill asks for investments in the infrastructure of small, culturally specific organizations that primarily serve the African American, Asian American, Latino American, and American Native Indians. These organizations serve the most vulnerable in our communities. For example, 93% of Asian elders are limited English, and almost 3 out of 4 Asian students are English learners, and just 57% own their own homes. According to the state demographer, Asian Minnesotans are a population of 256 and is the fastest growing population in the state, followed by blacks and Hispanics. We expect that by 2035, populations of color will be 25% of our state. So we think that these community organizations not only provide relevant services because they hire people who come from the community who are culturally and linguistically providing services to the community, but they also build an important workforce. These organizations are often the backbones for many in our communities who are striving to fully participate and contribute to Minnesota. For example, when my family came to America, we depended on these cultural organizations to help us acculturate and achieve our goals of economic self-sufficiency. My parents relied on the organizations to help them navigate complex government institutions and programs, and one such organization helped them pass their naturalization exam after failing on their own. Later on, my mother was able to become a licensed child care provider because of the support of one of these organizations. And today, we're proud that they are American citizens, they are homeowners, and they are entrepreneurs. As you know, Minnesota's growth in populations of color is not just in the Twin Cities. It is sometimes largest in all parts of other parts of Minnesota. So community nonprofits like the ones that help my parents, are important to thousands of Minnesotans who may otherwise find it challenging to navigate systems such as education, banking, housing, et cetera. In a little bit, Kate Barr, the executive director of the Nonprofits Assistance Fund, and Rebecca will be talking about their work. So Cal and our colleagues who are behind me, we are here because we believe that having your support for this bill will help to translate the services that these small organizations provide to meet the needs of our community, but also to build Minnesota's economy. And it really offers the opportunities for these small organizations to invest in their community by continuing to provide training for many who are entering the workforce for the first time so that they can enter other professions. The work of these nonprofits throughout Minnesota improves lives, strengthens communities and the economy, and lightens the burden on government tax dollars and society as a whole. So I'm here with my colleagues to request for your support of House File 2167 and to fully fund the program. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, we can, I know we're short on time, right? So we can take questions.
It's a good bill. We should all vote for it.
This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Any questions from members or comments? Representative Hamilton, any closing remarks?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you so much. And to all the testifiers, thank you for showing up here today. We apologize for being rushed, but as you can see, I think we have some support for that. Right.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. And with that, Representative Moran renews her motion to have House File 2167 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Saki. And Representative West, thank you. Come on up.
Yeah.
Sock. Representative? Sock. Is it sock? Representative, can you correct me on how I properly pronounce your name?
Sock.
Okay. So, first of all, I want to thank Representative West who agreed to bump his bill to later on Friday so that we could get your bill in today and testimony. This will be the final bill we have today. So, thank you, Representative West. And Representative Sock, do you have someone to move your bill?
I'll move it.
Representative Sundin moves House File 2078 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. And is the A1 amendment your amendment,
Representative? Yes.
The chair, Representative Sundin moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Representative Sock, to your bill, and thanks for bringing the treats.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, everybody, for your accommodation of our tough schedule and that sort of thing. Basically, what I'm doing is presenting an opportunity for us to continue to fund a community asset that has developed for us, and I'm going to let Randy Johnson go ahead and tell us about that program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Johnson. I'm Executive Director of Workforce Development Incorporated. We are the Workforce Development Board for Southeast Minnesota, the 10 counties based in Rochester. I'm here to talk about a program that is exemplary across the state. We use the term career pathways a lot, as we should. It's a great, great process. This is a program unlike others. It is a mature program. It has now been in operation in Rochester for 4+ years at the current level that it's dealing with. This program is now geared up to the point of having 250 people served per year with a waiting list. It has an amazing college completion rate of 85%. Those that are there, 93%. We have 100% of those that graduate are completing their required exams for state licensure and CNA, and they have now expanded into areas of health unit coordinator, phlebotomy, LPN, etc. They have 70% employment rate. These are living wage jobs. Another amazing stat, we have two-thirds plus of those that are going through these programs are people of color. It has a tremendous return on investment in this process. Our whole issue is that we've been funded, and our agency is the braider of funding for this. We use federal Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act funds. There's contributions in kind and in cash by the education district, by RCTC, and these are our prime partners. It is exemplary in the sense that there are three major partners that are absolutely equal in this process as we go forward and make this happen. But what's the issue here is that the state funds that are in play, which have now become more than half of our funds, have come through competitive grant processes. Things like Pathways to Prosperity, et cetera. And those funds tend to like new projects. They like new pilot projects. And we do need new projects. We do need pilot projects. But what do you do with one that has done nothing wrong and is the most successful project in the entire state, in fact, goes around the state giving lectures to others about how you do this? We do need to find a sustainable funding for this. We certainly have the sustainable flow of people. Because without it, to be honest, we will need to take this program apart come July 1, and the best program we've got in the state may not exist. So that is our purpose for asking for the funds.
Representative Sock, do you have any other testifiers?
We have two or three, but I don't know how much time you want to take at this. I know it's like zero.
One or two of you, maybe.
Members, just if you could, House File 1131, if you could just put that back in your packet so we can reuse it for a future time so we don't waste any paper. Welcome to the committee. Please state
Thank
your
you.
Name for the record.
I'm Nadine Holthoff.
Take as much time as you want.
It's okay. I know you guys are tired. I just wanted to walk you through what happens. I'm Nadine Holthoff. I'm the program manager at Hawthorne Education Center, and that's the Adult Basic Ed program in Rochester. And we partner with Workforce Development and Rochester Community Technical College, RCTC, in the Bridges to Healthcare program. I just want to walk you through what happens when a student comes to Hawthorne and wants to enter the Bridges to Healthcare program. We do reading, writing, math, and skills assessment to see if the student is academically ready to start the Bridges pathway. If their assessments show that they need skill development, we place them in our adult basic education classes. Hawthorne Bridge to College programming starts with our RCTC articulated classes. Most of our students on this pathway start by getting their nursing assistant certification, which allows them to work and continue their education. After achieving this step on their career pathway, they continue to become college prepared by taking RCTC developmental reading and writing classes at Hawthorne for free. This allows them to try college courses, work out life barriers, figure out how to balance life, school, and work in a safe and supportive environment while not incurring financial aid debt. A student can transfer up to 15 credits to RCTC. The information on all our health career pathways are in your folders. Career navigators, RCTC advisors, and Hawthorne staff work as a team to help our students successfully transfer to employment and post-secondary. We believe the success rate is due to academic preparedness and academic wraparound services, that workforce navigation support and RC transition support. The most important part of this collaboration is that all three partners work as a team to prepare diverse, low-income, underserved population to become financially stable. That's our purpose. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any other members of the public who wish to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
My name is Savita Kataria, and I'm one of the navigators for the program. So my title is Financial and Healthcare Navigator. It's a long title, but that's my title because I do two jobs. Two part of it, one is financial navigation and other is career counseling. So I work with these students and I provide direct financial and career navigation services to students facing financial barriers and other challenges to post-secondary education and seeking employment. And the challenges are while they're supporting themselves and their families and going to school. That's a lot of things to handle, but our students are mostly 67% out of that are coming from first generation, going to college, and facing many barriers along the way. As I was putting this together, what's my reward? Tears of joy. lots of hugs and smiles and so many thankful faces that says you have turned my life around, and that's what we do with this program. So just to give a glimpse of my little examples, one of the students just won Beat the Art scholarship at RCTC, and she just started 1.5 years ago with this program, tons of debt, and come through, and now she's Beat the Art scholarship winner for the college. This week, there are 5 students starting in Mayo School of Health Sciences, phlebotomy program, and that's 5 out of 12 students that are accepted in the program, highly competitive program. And so the 5 out of 5 got accepted, 5 applied, and 5 got accepted to the program. That speaks a lot for the outcome this program is giving. And I often hear back from the admission counselors that your students come with the most preparation, and they do not drop out like some others do, because 10 weeks program is very, very challenging and very hard. It requires a lot of work. So that's one thing we hear quite often on this. And helping students with student loans, I sit down with them through the phone calls. You know, they are coming. They don't even know that there is an option called repayment plan, that if they're not making money, how do they pay back? So they just think college is not for them. So many students have gone back to college because of somebody sat down with them and showed them the way around that. So that was another thing. And so these are some of the examples that we can go through. I have tons of, in just 1.5 years, I have examples that I can share, but because of the time, I'm going to just stop right here. And I appreciate your time for listening to this.
Sir, you'll be our final testifier for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Dale Amy, the Director of High School Collaborations at Rochester Community and Technical College. Our relationship with Hawthorne ABE is very strong. The Bridges to Healthcare program provided the opportunity for us to consider, research, and implement the articulation of several courses taught through the Adult Basic Ed at Hawthorne to actually transfer to RCTC. Current articulated courses are 2 developmental reading courses, 2 developmental writing courses, the CNA course, the Certified Nursing Assistant course, a CPR course, and the first year experience course. This has been provided a lot of great information for the students that are in this program. Now, I'm told that this type of an articulation is unprecedented, but clearly the right thing to do for our ABE partners and our students. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Salk, any closing comments?
Only that I can't express how much this is a diversified program in our community. This is providing labor force that is skilled and ready to work across all the areas, and from Mayo Clinic all the way into nursing homes and all the way into, as you heard, some kids are turning around and going right into RCTC for full education and degrees and that sort of thing. So it's taking people that otherwise have lost their pathway and allowing them a pathway to get back in. The reason we're here for straight funding is because the grant systems tended to run out on this. It's a mature, very successful system, and it is also a model for other areas around the state currently, that they come and look at how this is done and or this group goes to help them get their systems working. And yet we're about to orphan it as the core home designer of this kind of a interrelated, interactive labor force development program. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, Representative Sundin renews his motion to have House File 2788 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. And Representative, find me on the floor so we can follow up on this bill, okay? With that, members, that completes our agenda for the day. Thank you again to Representative West for being accommodating. Members, a reminder that the committee will meet on Friday. So with that, we are adjourned.